Desire mercy, not sacrifice. For I have come to call not the righteous, but sinners. Amen. Last week in church, as is true every week, our prayers of the people included a recognition of all those celebrating birthdays. As is not true every week, but of course only once per year, my name was among those prayed for. When church ended, I walked out towards the parish hall. Someone stopped me and wished me a happy birthday. They asked how old I was turning. When I replied that I'd be 30, they said, "Oh, wow, you won't be trustworthy anymore." And you know when you hear something that you don't understand at all? And you so clearly and obviously don't understand it that you don't bother to ask what they mean. You just say, "Yes, of course." I found myself in that exact position. So I chuckled and I nodded, but I'm thinking, what is this supposed to mean? Why would I not be trustworthy? And so a few minutes go by and I'm eating on my Danish or whatever it was in the parish hall, and someone comes up to me again and says, "Happy birthday, how old are you turning?" And I tell them, and they says, "Oh gee, can't trust anyone over 30. And so now I'm curious. A couple more people ask, and I say, "What is this from?" And the person says something like, "Well, I don't know, it's just always been a saying." Now, mind you, I had not heard this anywhere in any place except for here. So I hear this again two or three more times until finally, on my birthday, I get a text saying, you can't trust somebody over 30. And I'm like, what is going on here? And finally, they say, "You're too young. It was during the late 60s and people being drafted for Vietnam didn't think that we should have to fight a war for old people over 30. Fair enough. So this piques my interest, and I decide that I'll do what any old, untrustworthy 30-year-old would then do. I type, "Don't trust anyone over 30, into Google, and believe everything that I read. The saying is attributed to Jack Weinberg, a student at Cal Berkeley who founded what was called the Free Speech Movement. After traveling the South, learning from the civil rights workers in the late summer of 1963, Jack and others began more strategically to engage in political and social landscapes of their university and their surrounding city. This movement would give birth to the first broad-scale acts of civil disobedience on college campuses in the 1960s, eventually informing and giving shape to a generation of young people growing up amidst remarkable dissension and upheaval. In the course of Jack's work with the Free Speech Movement, he was interviewed by the San Francisco Chronicle. During the interview, the reporter repeatedly implied that his movement was not organically created by Jack and by his peers, but that they instead were puppets acting on the whims of larger, nefarious organizations who wanted to manufacture dissent amongst the American people. Increasingly annoyed with this reporter's line of questioning, Jack quipped almost sarcastically, "We have a saying in this movement that you can't trust anybody over 30. Of the statement, Jack noted, it was a way of telling the guy to back off, that nobody was pulling our strings. But it went, of course, from journalist to journalist, then leaders in that movement started using it because they saw the extent to which it shook up that older generation. By 1990, in an interview, he reflected, "I've done some things in my life that I think are very important. And my one sentence in history turns out to be something I said off the top of my head, which became completely distorted and misunderstood." Last week, Reverend Millie, and I say this proudly because she takes every opportunity that she can to embarrass me. Last week, Reverend Millie gave what I feel was her most poignant sermon since I've been here at Grace. She spoke at length about the Surgeon General's report on what's being called the epidemic of loneliness. It resonated so deeply with me, and I suspect with most of you, as I thought about what I've borne witness to in my own ministry. I thought about the 30 years of my life, beginning in 1993 up until where we find ourselves today. I considered the ways in which technology had so widely broadened our opportunity to communicate, and yet so too has often left communication devastatingly shallow and something other than human. I thought about the ways in which so much of our work today as clergy and as followers of Christ more broadly is to offer true engagement, person to person love, the opportunity to truly be seen in the flesh. I thought about how the very foundation of our nature as a church body is about our humanness, about what happens in person, that you step into these walls and in hands lifted with the soft utterance of prayer together, you just feel something. You can't describe it. You just feel something when you're together. And so I read through the report myself to better understand the situation in which we find ourselves, and one particular idea from the report stuck out to me, and I hope that I can help to build on some of the words from last Sunday. The idea is something like this. Isolation does not lead to no relationships at all. Instead, isolation leads us to distorted relationships. The Surgeon General used a quite simple illustration regarding the rise in gang membership since the 1970s. People who feel isolated, and perhaps more accurately, people who feel alienated, are more likely to find tenuous relationship networks and systems of meaning. We are intrinsically motivated to seek out connection, and when we don't find meaningful or soulful connection with any consistency, we'll seek out the best possible alternative. Sometimes these alternatives, of course, are not good at all. I'm convinced that this crisis of isolation is fed by a concurrent crisis of communication. This notion is reflected again in the Surgeon General's report, wherein the topic of technological harm is discussed. This harm happens when technology does not supplement or enhance our in-person communication, but instead displaces it. FaceTiming mom feels sort of like being right there in the living room, doesn't it? Streaming church feels sort of like sitting in that usual comfortable pew, doesn't it? Discussing politics over Facebook sort of feels like discussing politics at your neighborhood block party, doesn't it? With some consistency, relationship and communication have been replaced with things that sort of feel like the real thing, sometimes more often than we get to experience the thing itself. Jesus in Matthew's gospel, I promise I'm getting there. I will never preach a sermon that entirely disregards the gospel. Jesus in Matthew's gospel sees Matthew in the tax booth, and what does Jesus say? Jesus says, "Follow me." Matthew is isolated. And look, he is not without relationship entirely, but instead is engaged in what we might consider distorted relationship, in distorted systems of meaning. Matthew is among the reviled, seen as a traitor to his own people, acting as a proxy for an occupying empire. And in turn, the expectation, of course, is that he is frozen out of meaningful groups. Matthew is resented by the people around him. But Jesus' heart tells him that Matthew's isolation and Matthew's behaviors are intertwined. In that moment, I believe Jesus' gut tells him that Matthew needs to sit down for dinner. Jesus sees that Matthew needs to be among somebody who will love him. The sight of Jesus and his disciples, these so-called holy people, at dinner with those considered unclean because of their jobs or because of their bad opinions doesn't add up. How can it be virtuous to sit amidst the unholy? When the disciples receive question about this unlikely dinner party, Jesus responds, "Those who are well have no need of a physician, but those who are sick. Go and learn what this means. I desire mercy, not sacrifice. For I have come to call not the righteous, but the sinners. We do not build better hearts, better lives for ourselves, or a better world in the constant pursuit of cleanliness. If we are to believe Jesus here, and if we are to believe the prophet Hosea, who Jesus here quotes, then our sacrifice is not found in any tangible thing that we give, that we offer, not in a pound of flesh, but in the sense of mercy that we carry in our hearts. Our sacrifice is found in our attempt to create true and authentic networks of community that bring together different people from different places in the constant pursuit of reminding everyone that they are indeed children of God. Our disposition is such that we work to create distinction. Never trust anyone over 30. It's how we're programmed. Or on the other hand, never trust a movement of young adults. They don't know any better. They can't possibly think for themselves. In that crucible of mistrust, of course, progress is possible, but reconciliation and the building of true, sustainable networks of community is absent. I truly believe that we are at such a critical juncture in our history together as a human family, where we have an opportunity to choose to heal collectively or to descend further into this already identified isolation, polarization, and mistrust. It's true that we can't control the rhythms of powers and principalities in their fullness. I suspect they may continue to choose those very ills. What we can control is what we have right here within these stone walls. And more than that, we can control with the help of grace of God what is right here in each of our hearts. And these hearts are nourished and tended, kept healthy by the people who sit right beside you. We depend on one another. We have depended on one another, and we can find new ways to invite people in to this network, new ways to invite ourselves in to where we are already at, to be more meaningfully and deeply engaged. We can create the table that we read about here in the Gospels, perhaps not everywhere, but at least here. We have that option. It is in our control. And a bigger table, a more full table, is urgently needed in our own world today. A reminder that the person who sits alongside you is the child of God is urgently needed. A reminder, in fact, that I and the beloved child of God, meaning all of you, is needed. That is the foundation for trust. I trust that I am beloved and that you are beloved. From that, of course, I seek no sacrifice, no pound of flesh. I need nothing more than for you to be you. That is what we seek to teach at this table. Our table is draped in a cloth of mercy, and from it a great love will flow. Amen.